Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. All right, we are going to have a short discussion right now, a dialogue on the subject of political engagement. And obviously the issue is something that is important for all of us because of the fact that many Muslims in the West, especially those who have migrated here, are having a hard time in trying to engage themselves in the politics of this country, in trying to get representation, in trying to raise a voice, in trying to join or make a way for them to raise their voice in this country. So this is something that a lot of people are not understanding, or they have fears in understanding. So with me I have in this forum here, Brother Dawood, who is an officer at CARE. He's in charge of the CARE here in Detroit. This is his hometown. And then we have Media Benjamin, who is a very active personality, and she is from Code Pink, which is an anti-war organization, also for human rights, to stand up for human rights, and she's been very active, and we have her here. And then we have Dr. Barrett, who has joined here last year also, and we welcome him this year, and he's also a political activist and a radio show host, if I'm staying there, that's great. And also we have Hujjat Islam al-Muslimin, Maulana Elia, also with us to join us. So I'm not going to waste any more time. I'm going to get this started right away. Political engagement, right? So when we look at this, obviously for people here, we need to understand the term engaging in politics. So if we can get that started off, you know, I can ask Dr. Barrett to help us to get started off in understanding what does political engagement mean in this country.
Well, in the official understanding of things, the United States is a democratic republic founded on the principles of the Enlightenment, and the citizenry is expected to be well informed about all issues, especially political issues, and to participate in the governance of the country. That's the official understanding of things here, and I wish it really worked that way, and I hope it will work that way better in the future. Unfortunately, this country has drifted far from its philosophical origins, which it already was hypocritical at the beginning, but today I think we're living in a time when the whole concept of ordinary people participating in the governance of their own lives has fallen by the wayside. We've seen the emergence of a brutal Orwellian oligarchy that is ruling through big lies and, to some extent, mass murder. About 4 million Muslims have been killed around the world since 9/11, according to one count anyway, in a false flag war on Islam. And here we are in a country that's supposed to be self-governing, run by the people, and we're guaranteed religious freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of expression under the Constitution. Supposedly, the Constitution that has been partially suspended since the state of emergency that was declared on 9/11, and that's still a state secret. We can't read the state of emergency declaration that does exist. So we're living in a state of emergency both as Americans and as Muslims. And we need to understand that fact as we look around us and say, what's the purpose of my existence here in this place in this time? If we are Muslims and reasonably aware of what's going on around us in the United States of America at this moment, we have the duty to stand up for the highest ideals both of the Deen of Islam and of the American Constitutional Democratic Republic. And I'm sure the others will have some suggestions about where to go with that.
Yeah, the disparity that lies between what he says is in writing in the Constitution or in founding papers as to what America should be and what it is in reality. In your experience, media, what do you say, you know, in regards to this disparity that exists there?
Well, it's a tough thing because you don't want people to get so cynical and so discouraged that they don't do anything. On the other hand, you want to be honest and say, no matter who you vote for, it's still going to be Wall Street that rules. It's still going to be the 1%. It's still going to be the military-industrial complex that's going to try to keep us in a state of perpetual war. So I think you want to find the fine line between saying that, unfortunately, money has so corrupted our political system system. Yet, on the other hand, we do have a lot more freedoms than many people around the world have, and we have to exercise those freedoms more. And I think in the end, mass movements can trump big money. Trump used on purpose. Big money politics can trump these overarching forces that tend to rule our society, but that's only if we really build mass movements.
That's great. Now, as for Muslims here in this country, right, Brother Dawood has been involved in so many Muslim issues in dealing with the system over here. How do you see this disparity? And I mean, what is your take on us really, you know, having faith in the system like this?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله الذين أذبوا الله وعلم الرزة وتحرهم تطيرا
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى آله.
One of the shortcomings, I believe, Maulana, of the American Muslim community when it comes to justice and political engagement is that for far too long, as a community, and I'm speaking primarily those who have come here to the United States of America post-1965, after the Immigration Act of 1965 and their children, is that many of us as Muslims, we've been working off of the collective paradigm of justice means just us. That our framework of what we think about justice predominantly resides only in caring about Muslims primarily, and then Muslims halfway across the world, not the Muslims who are drinking poison water in Flint, not the Muslims who are living in poverty in Detroit or Highland Park, Michigan, but halfway across the world, which obviously we should be concerned about what's going on in Pakistan. And like one of my teachers in Yemen was killed by a terrorist in a suicide bombing, right? So we should be concerned, but part of our failure is that we've been very myopic in our view of justice, and justice meaning just us and our limited and predominantly ethnocentric framework. So what this has done is this has separated us from other grassroots movements that Medea was talking about, where we actually can effectuate change. And I'll say this, that one of the movements that's caused the most social awareness in the last 40 years is the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, Black Americans are still getting killed by the police once every 28 hours, including the video that was just shown about Paul O'Neill in Chicago. Like, we get, Black people in America get killed more than how we were lynched in 1960s. We're killed more by the police than we were lynched in the 60s. Nonetheless, at least it's starting a conversation, right? And at least there are people who are non-Black who are joining an allyship and taking to the streets. So in order for us to deal with Islamophobia better, we have to have more intersectionality. And through intersecting these multiple movements, we can then, as Medea said, God willing, we can defeat some of this big money that has corrupted the political system here in these United States of America.
I just want to get Maulana Ilya involved in this, right? You see, a lot of times, you know, we see that, I'm taking from Brother Dawood what he said, is that we do not take part in the society that we live in. In fact, we isolated ourselves and just think of ourselves, and the only news we watch is that which is concerned with the Middle East or something like that, which is important, but there are other issues here also. Like sometimes what happened is that there was one incident I remember where a young girl was killed by someone, and this young girl was also raped by someone. And so what happened is that the whole city was alarmed by this. They were shocked by this, and they all came out to her house for a vigil to support the parents, right? And when one of us went there, right, we didn't see Muslims there. We saw everyone else. We didn't see Muslims there. So how can we expect the people here to understand our issues when we don't take part in their issues? How can we encourage our people to take part in the life that is actually happening around them, if you can say that?
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله بالعالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Amen. I think lots of people in our communities are undergoing in a phase of transition, migrating from various Islamic countries to the United States, and they need to realize that when we live in this community, we have huge set of responsibilities on our shoulders about those who are around us, right here in the United States, in our neighbors. We have this, like, the Black Lives Matter movement, we have the minorities affairs, we have the Native American Indian affairs, we have the Latino American issues, we have other minorities who are being targeted, and from our Islamic perspective, there is no way a believer can make any distinction between events that are unfolding somewhere thousands of miles away in some Islamic country and the events that are unfolding right here in the United States. We consider every human being to be respectable, and we need to speak up about the affairs related to the minorities, to the blacks, to anybody else who is oppressed. And from the Islamic perspective, again, our religion makes it not just a human responsibility from the human perspective, in terms of humanity, but actually it's a spiritual and a religious responsibility to speak up. And the first stage of that is to know. Lots of people don't know what's going on. They don't realize, they don't understand. Information, learning about your rights. And the second step after we learn about our rights, we need to build some courage in ourselves. So we should not get intimidated. We should realize that our unity will provide power for us if we join hands with the rest of the communities around us. For all those issues which we share with them, if we unite with all those people who are around us for the common goals, we as a united community will end up having much more stronger power. And another thing which is important to focus is the right to vote. It's good in the United States that we have a constitution. Which secures the First Amendment right, secures our freedom of religion. I understand what the professor has said, which is true. Unfortunately, there are bills and policies passed by the Congress, and right now the United States is being run under those bills and policies. But it's our responsibility as citizens of this country, as people living in and being part of the fabric of this community, to join our hands with rest of the people and rest of the faiths. And this is how we can gain our strength, stepping out of our ethnic background, stepping out of our box, inside the box thinking, and open up and live a life where we are open to embrace the rest of the people who are living in our community, and giving them equal respect, and stand together, united for our common goals.
Thank you very much. A lot of times, speaking about getting involved in politics, right? We see that a lot of people are intimidated, and some people obviously make our civic responsibility. They summarize it and they only limit it to voting. Now, what's your impression on that? Just voting, or is it more than that, where you think that Muslims can really get involved in much stronger and deeper ways?
Well, unfortunately, voting today is often quite futile, as I think anyone who's pondering the choice of the two major party candidates in this presidential election will quickly realize. I think we need to, as we heard from the other guests, think about, first understand what's really going on. And once we're clear about the way the world works today, we need to then think about not just working together with other groups, which is true, but which groups to work with and in pursuit of which goals. And we should be thinking about the goals that will solve many issues at once. It's great to be working on each of these. There's so many different oppressed people in the world, so many important issues. But the question is, what can we do that will have the most influence on many of these issues at once? And I would argue that we should be thinking in terms not of uniting with the current power structure, but rather of uniting with the various disenfranchised groups and people who are aware of what's really going on against the core hidden element of that power structure, which is causing almost all of these other problems. For instance, the killing of black people by police, that has been a scandal throughout my whole lifetime. When I was a teenager in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I quickly discovered that the police in Milwaukee were regularly brutalizing and killing black people and getting away with it and lying about it. I ended up getting permanently, partially paralyzed in my hands from police abuse later when I was a young man. And so I'm very aware of this. But this is not so much an issue, I think, that we can solve in isolation. It's a symptom. And all of the hoopla around this issue right now is actually partially being driven by our rulers as part of a divide and conquer strategy to break up the working class between the sort of white reactionary Donald Trump people on the one hand and the pro-Black Lives Matter people on the other hand, so they can get a big race war going in order to distract from who we should really be uniting to fight, which is the usurers who run this country and this world. That is the target. In politics, as Leo Strauss and Carl Schmitt, the two most influential political philosophers of this century, had an insight which, even though they're disgusting people and it's a disgusting philosophy, is very important, and that is, they said that politics is based on enmity. That is, politics is the science of uniting people against someone or something. And unfortunately, there is some truth to that. And I think we need to recognize that the people who understand this, who are basically psychopaths, who run the world through their usury system of banking by creating most of the world's currency supply, lending it into existence at interest out of nothing, and thereby giving themselves an unlimited amount of money to accomplish anything they want, and then they're using that money to distract and divide us and to lie to us and get us fighting amongst ourselves so that we don't change that system. So I would argue that if we actually understand what's going on in the world, rather than getting distracted on various kinds of issues that can be manipulated by the forces of divide and conquer, we should go straight to the heart of the matter and follow our Islamic teachings and say, end usury, the banking system. The problem isn't just the 1%, it is the tiny minority of families, the 0.00001%, who are creating the currency that dominates the world out of nothing, lending it into existence and interest. We must end the Reba system of currency and overthrow the people who are running the world through that system. That's the most important issue, and we can unite the 99.99% on the basis of that issue and solve a lot of these other problems all in one fell swoop.
Wow. Inshallah. So, that's, I think, enlightening for many people about the idea of voting and just voting being something that's not really the solution to many things, because a lot of times when our people are asked to become active in politics, they're said, we need to vote, and that's it. And I think, you know, that's an insight into the fact that just voting is not the answer. It's a much bigger answer than what you said. Now, obviously, you know, when you stand up against the system, it's not that easy. And I don't think anyone in this room knows more about standing up against a system than Media Benjamin here, right? Who, just reading up on her, you know, as soon as she gets arrested somewhere else, then she's seen somewhere else standing up for something else, you know? So in your experience, right, what do you think about the, you know, a person standing up for what they believe in, you know, and how should they go about doing it?
The first thing I think is to lose the fear factor. Certainly there are some people here that don't have U.S. citizenship and are worried about being deported, and I understand that, and there's limits then to what you can do. But for those who are U.S. citizens, there's a lot that we can do. And there's a lot that we can do together. Voting is something we do every 2 years, president every 4 years, and it's a good time to be looking at the system and talking about the system and doing things like Bernie Sanders did, which was to build a movement out of the electoral process. But then once we elect or select these people, we have to hold them accountable to us. And there are many ways of doing that. We have done sit-ins in congressional offices constantly and just keep going back and keep going back and keep going back until they finally listen to us. And we often start out with the congresspeople or the senators who are most likely to listen to us. For example, Elizabeth Warren, very progressive on many issues. Well, the last time that Israel invaded Gaza, she took the same line as any right-wing person and said it's Israel's right to defend itself. And we were so offended by having a woman who is supposedly rooted in social justice issues coming out and justifying the killing of innocent Palestinians that we went into her office dressed in black, shrouds, with dolls broken up and with fake blood on them, rubble that we made out of styrofoam, and dumped it all in her office and sat in her office like wailing women, just, you know, crying in the office. And they didn't know what to do with us. You know, they didn't want to call the police to kick us out because it wouldn't look good. And yet it was going on, and they couldn't get their work done. And finally, they agreed to have us meet with the senator. And we told her that you just can't take this position that Israel can kill as many Palestinians as it wants because there's a big lobby group called AIPAC. And after that, I wouldn't say she's the best on Palestine, but she has changed her position, not just because we sat in there, but also because we worked with people throughout Massachusetts to do sit-ins in all her local offices, to flood her offices with calls. So there's a lot of things that we can do to change the position of people.
Well, very well. That's, you know, now you bring up AIPAC, right, and lobbies, right? And one of the things that obviously, you know, we look at in trying to get engaged politically is we have to stand up against big lobbies, well-grounded, deep-rooted lobbies that go very deep in the pockets of many politicians here. Your experience, you know, what do you say, you know, how do we deal with that?
Well, there's a couple of things. The first thing is, and this is the importance of Muslim unity, but it's really a shame that we don't have an Islamic think tank in Washington, D.C. that we can disseminate information and then actually have a real lobbying group to challenge a lot of these policies on the macro level. It doesn't exist. Like, for instance, CARES National Office in D.C., but we deal with civil rights. We're putting out the fires of Islamophobia. Our job is not to, like, do extensive research and then disseminate it to lobby around Palestine. We simply don't have the bandwidth, nor is that our expertise, but that's just one example. We don't have this, and this is something across madhahib, across ethnic background, that I think Muslims should be committed to, and I've been trying to plant this seed for years, you know, that perhaps I'm not the one to start it, but I'm hoping if I plant this seed enough that there will be some interested people, educated people who will start this endeavor. But I also like to shift, Maulana, that when we talk about politics, the late Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, said all politics is local. And while we look at things about foreign policy or like Trump or Clinton, like what about our school boards? that we can influence or run on or vote, that so we can change or influence school curriculum that's teaching our children? What about the zoning boards and planning commissions in which throughout many of our cities they block the zoning for construction and expansion projects of Madaris and Misajit? Like, we're so busy thinking about the national elections that the place that we can have perhaps the quickest impact is actually on the local level, where we actually can take control and have a little bit of power. I mean, not unless you live in Michigan, like in Detroit, where our governor took away our vote through the emergency manager, right? And then that's what led to the poisoning of water in Flint. But in general, right, like we can make, I think, the most impact on the local level. So when we're talking about politics and political engagement, just don't limit your mindset to the national politic.
So local involvement obviously has a lot more impact, and we can be more influential in local politics than in national politics, taking the numbers, obviously, and this is a number game. I'll just open it up for you. This number game that we have, obviously we are a minority, not even a minority, a very small minority in this country, right? How with that sort of being a minority, right, do you think our role is, and what role can we play? You know, obviously, you know, we are not, you know, I mean, for example, we don't have the history of the Jewish lobby, which has been here for a longer time, and they are rich, and they have money, and all of these things. Like, how do Muslims, with the small numbers that they have, truly make an impact in the society, if anyone wants to take that?
I'll make a quick comment about that. You mentioned the Jewish example, and there's some things that we can learn from the Jewish community in regards to, because the American Muslim community and the Jewish American community are about the same percentage, right? Like, they're not a very large community in the American demographic. What is very different, and it goes to our political intelligence and how we organize, is that this country was established upon white supremacy, right? And the construct of whiteness has evolved over time. So at one time, Irish people were not considered white in America. They had their own separate box, white and Irish. Jewish people were not socially political white. Jewish people eventually got their socio-political white card. That is impossible for the American Muslim community. So therefore, it's really impossible. Most of you in here are brown. There's some black folk in here, right? So you're not, and then why would we want to get our white card? Because to be considered white in America means that you're on top of the racial hierarchy, which means other people are below you. That's against Islam. Wait, we don't believe in racial hierarchy. In akramakum inda Allahi atqakum. That's what the Quran says, right? So within this context, if we're talking about us being a small part of the political process, I mean, of the demographic of America, this is why it makes it even more incumbent upon us to find our community's natural allies, and that we build power and we organize with our natural allies, which are predominantly other marginalized communities of color, as well as good-hearted white people. I mean, otherwise we can't, the numbers statistically are against us, right? So that's the only way that we can do that, which also means, going back to my other point, justice can't be just us. We have to be marching in the streets and involved in other people's stuff. When Trump is talking about, let's build that wall, we should be down there with Latinos and line up and lay down there and say, no, no wall, right? Like, so that's what we need to do.
Thank you for that. You know, and just to add to that, so I can get more into Aldia, to really, you know, it's an important issue for us here. Really important is that fact that, you know, us trying to build a, you know, trying to be a factor in the society requires that we also have a unity amongst ourselves, a leadership, a unity, a hierarchy, where people are together and they have the same idea of all the major issues that we face here. What do you think is happening right now, and what are we doing in order to create that sort of a base, a platform for ourselves?
Because the demographics are not in our favor, in the sense that our numbers are less, very much comparable to the Jewish community, like Brother Dawood said. So in these times, it's even more important to remember what our religion teaches us. I will again focus on the religious point of view, which is unity. And to avoid those factors, those elements who are disuniting between Shia and Sunni, which is a very common issue that we are facing. And especially when we find that there are certain lobbies who are enemies of both of these communities, and they are feeding into this problem intentionally for their agendas. It's our responsibility to realize that we should not allow in our masjids, in our mosques in the United States, to sow the seeds of disunity amongst ourselves. So our community has to be united. And according to the statistics, more than 80% of the mosques are under the direct influence of the Saudi lobby. So, and obviously when we learn that, it's clear that they are going to spread their own takfiri ideology, which means calling everyone else to be an infidel. So the non-Muslims are infidel, the Muslims are infidel, everybody is an infidel in their eyes, and which is the best tool to serve the agenda of the enemies, which is divide and rule. It's our responsibility to maintain unity in our ranks, and to identify those people who are sowing the seeds of disunity, and to build bridges. If you look at the Holy Quran, it's not just about Muslims. The Holy Quran is clear. It says, even to the people of the book, who are the people of the book? The Jews and the Christians. Quran is clearly saying, Ta'alaw ila kalimatin sawa'in baynana wa baynakum. Right? Quran is clearly asking us to build bridges even with them based on our principles that we all believe and share. So oneness of God, Tawheed. So we have certain common things that we need to keep in our mind and build these bridges with those people around us. And I agree the Jewish community has lots of money, but what I will disagree is that the Muslim community is in shortage of money. In my personal information, we have so many professionals and so many doctors and surgeons and so many people of various professions who are making a lot of money. So it would be unfair to say that the Muslim community is lacking the funds. What we are lacking is unity in our ranks. We must focus on making sure that nothing absolutely can stop us from having the unity among ourselves. Thank you.
In other words, we need larger bridges, not larger walls. Right? So, Media, you wanted to add something to that?
When I was at the Republican convention and Donald Trump was speaking, I managed to get inside and unfurled a banner and interrupted him during the speech with the sign that said, build bridges, not walls. So I certainly agree with that sentiment. But I do want to make an exception, which I think you just referred to, which is Saudi Arabia. And that is that we have to expose the influence of Saudi Arabia in our domestic and foreign policies, and do something to educate the American people about how the spread of Wahhabism has so twisted people's perception of Islam, and how the U.S. ties with Saudi Arabia have so twisted the kind of foreign policy we would like to have. And when you see that our ties with Saudi Arabia are now focused on the billions of dollars of weapons that we sell to that country, then Saudi Arabia is really holding up the military-industrial complex in this country that keeps us in the state of perpetual war, that robs us of the money that we need for a really good healthcare system in this country, that robs us of the money we need to provide free education for our young people like they deserve, that robs us of the money we need to build the kind of infrastructure we deserve, the kind of green economy we need for the planet to survive. So I think for all of these reasons, it's so important for us as a community, and I come from the Jewish community, but for a much broader community, to really speak out against the U.S.-Saudi ties and do something in this election season to show how Hillary Clinton has taken millions of dollars from the Saudi government for her foundation, how Donald Trump, even though he pretends that he's against the wars, he is going to continue the same policies if he gets into office. And so I would like to work with all of you to figure out how we can do more to demand an end to weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, to promote the rights of the Shia community inside Saudi Arabia, and to really do more to cut the U.S. ties with this repressive regime.
Well, that's right. You know, and we want to bring Saudi Arabia to court in order that they answer for their involvement in 9/11 also, right? The 19 of the people who are claimed to have done it are from Saudi Arabia, right? And we are all about that. And how do we get to that? That's the issue. How do we get to that?
I think that Medea is absolutely right. And this 28 pages issue and the bill currently in Congress to allow American victims of 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia, I think we should be working for that. But we should also keep in mind that what we're working for is an exposure of the full truth around September 11th. And that is that not just the Saudis, but actually far more so the Israelis and the friends in the United States, the treasonous friends of the Saudis and the Israelis, are the people that did 9/11. And once that truth comes out, the whole game will change in a very, very positive way. So that's why this 9/11 truth issue and the related issue of false flag terrorism and the deep state is so important. And here's what you can do as Muslims that we are so beautifully situated to do. I think we're talking about what we're only 2% like Jewish people in the United States. What can we actually, what are we situated to be able to accomplish? I think there are two totally different levels where we're really well situated. The first, Brother Dawood already mentioned, which is the local level. That's the school boards, the local city council, the county board, the even maybe the state assembly. We should be running candidates for office at these lower levels and getting active at that level, because we have a big preponderance in certain communities and neighborhoods, and we can have a real influence in those places, and we're perfectly set up to do that. We just have to jump in there. Those elections mean something. The national ones, I don't think, do, but the local ones mean something. The local level is very real. We have a tremendous amount of democracy still going at the local level. Get involved. The second thing that we're perfectly situated to do is to lead the process of exposing the deep state, the criminals who repeatedly have staged coups d'etat, not only all over the world. Turkey was just the latest example of an attempted coup by people who have overthrown dozens and dozens of governments all over the world, and normally they overthrow better governments to insert worse governments, and they've done it not only around the world, but here in the United States as well. Essentially, the same loose group of people murdered the Kennedy brothers and Dr. Martin Luther King and Malcolm X in the 1960s. They murdered many, many other people all over the world, Allende in Chile on September 11th, 1973. They've murdered Paul Wellstone, the best senator we had in the United States, because he wanted to expose 9/11 and he wanted to stop the war in Iraq. So Dick Cheney threatened his life 1 week before his plane went down, killing himself, his wife, his daughter, and his campaign staff. The deep state has been staging false flag terror events. Orlando is only the latest. These are totally theatrical. These are not what they tell you in the media happened, did not happen, and it's obvious it didn't happen if you look behind the scenes. Muslims know this. The poll polls show that 80% of the world's Muslims and two-thirds of U.S. Muslims know that 9/11 was an inside job. But what are we doing to spread the news? I'm not asking you to do what I'm doing and jump up and down in public, you know, screaming it from the top of your lungs and making a career out of it. That's what I'm doing. What I'm asking you to do is to share it on social media, share DVDs, share my books and other books exposing this, because the deep state is a terrible problem. They're getting away with murder, literally, these crimes against humanity that are so awful and so revealing as to how this organized crime cabal that's lurking in the shadows of our supposedly democratic system really works. And, you know, when Dr. Martin Luther King was killed, we know more about that killing than any other murder in the history of the world. We know everything about it. The man who pulled the trigger, his name, he's still alive. Dr. William Pepper, the attorney for the King family, just talked to him and had lunch with the guy who pulled the trigger of the bullet that didn't kill Dr. King, because he was killed in the hospital by U.S. government people who were pre-situated there, and the whole thing was filmed on the rooftop by U.S. Army photographers, and they had snipers on the rooftops to back up that killing. And we know the names of all these people, and they've all confessed. Many of them have confessed. Why haven't you heard this elsewhere? The mainstream media won't cover these issues that expose the deep state. Muslims are perfectly situated to help expose the deep state. You don't have to do it in the big way I'm doing it. Do it in a little way. Spread the books, the DVDs, the messages. Do it gently to your coworkers, your neighbors. Do it, you know, with a smile. And if they freak out and don't want to hear about it, turn and talk to somebody else. We can do this. We know this information. So let's get out there and change the world with it.
Thank you.
Now, speaking of books, right, both Dr. Barrett has written books, you know, and also Media Benjamin has written books, you know, and there's a book that she has right now. If you can introduce that book to us, tell us about it.
Well, it just came out about 2 days ago. It's called Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Connections. And it's really meant to be a primer to educate the American public on what the Saudi government is about, what is its attitudes towards religious freedom for the non-Sunni community, what is its attitude towards migrant workers. We now know that there's over 10,000 Indian workers who are basically indentured servants trying to even get out of Saudi Arabia, don't even have the right to leave, looks at the role of women, and then gets into the international issues and the connections. So I recommend it to you or anybody who really wants to learn more about Saudi Arabia and the U.S.-Saudi connection, and who might want to invite me to speak in your community, because I am going on a six-month speaking tour and using it as a time during the elections and beyond to build a very broad movement that can start not only questioning the ties, but doing something about it. And while I agree with Daoud that we have to work on the local level, I'm actually amazed at how we can have an influence at the international level, even when we're a relatively small number of people doing this kind of work. For example, we've teamed up with other groups to protest the sale of cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia, because cluster bombs are a weapon that has been condemned by the international community. And because of our work, we have at least gotten the president to put a hold on the sale of cluster bombs, which is a very good first start. Many of you are concerned about the issue of Israel-Palestine, and you know there is a very broad-based movement worldwide called the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, also known as BDS. This is a fabulous movement that you would think the leaders of this country would say, thank goodness there is a movement that is a non-violent way for people to stand up for human rights, and instead we get Hillary Clinton saying that we've got to fight against BDS, and we have people in the Democratic Party even who are passing laws to make it illegal to be part of the BDS movement. This is something that we have to stand up for now and say that a boycott movement is part of our tradition here in the United States, from the civil rights movement, the great boycott of the farm workers, that we will stand up for what we believe in, and we will use our pocketbooks, and we will use our ideals as consumers to stand up for what we believe in.
Thank you. So we are now almost at the end, right? We are just going to get some final comments from all of you, you know, regarding what you can advise people here, right? You know, in regards to how they can involve themselves, you know, in a political way, or if they have any fears or intimidations, how they can get over that.
Two things, and one just, and I think a slight clarification. We should not refer to Wahhabis as Sunnis. The Wahhabi movement is not part of Ahlul Sunnah. And mainstream Sunnis in Saudi Arabia are marginalized. So that's one thing that we have to clarify. The most important thing, I think, for us, before we talk about furu' or branches and how we're going to do things, is usul, right? Like we're taught this in our deen for those of us who have studied sacred knowledge. One of the most important things I think Muslim communities need to do is that we need to instill and do a better job at instilling self-love in our communities. Once we love ourselves more, then this will help get rid of some of this fear, and we will stand up for what we believe and what we think is good for our community and our countries because we love ourselves. And we love ourselves too much that we're gonna allow ourselves to be treated any old kind of way, and we love humanity too much to see humanity be oppressed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Kevin, you want to go ahead?
You mentioned, how do we get past the fear factor? And, you know, that's, I think you just have to kind of try and go ahead and, you know, do it and feel a little bit of fear. And maybe if you step back if you have to. My aunt was a psychotherapist, and she and my uncle both were better at curing phobias than anybody. And they trained psychotherapists from all over the world in how to cure phobias. People who are, for instance, afraid of snakes or afraid of heights. And the way you do it is you introduce them to what they're afraid of in small doses. For instance, with heights, the person goes up on the first rung of a ladder and then gets comfortable, and then the second rung, and then they get comfortable. And pretty soon they're up at the top of the ladder, and then they're up at the top of the mountain, and they're fine. Likewise, with a snake, you give them a little toy model of a snake that's not realistic, and then a little bigger and more realistic one, and pretty soon they've got a boa constrictor wrapped around their neck, and they're happy, you know, they got a pet boa constrictor. So this is how you get past phobias. You do, like I used to be afraid of public speaking. I was the world's worst public speaker. In fact, I actually got an F in my public speaking class because I didn't show up for the exam in college. The only course in my life I ever got an F in. And my mom looks at me now on press TV and says, "Well, what happened to you? You know, you were such a shy little boy, Kevin." The catastrophe that happened to me was I studied teaching. I had to practice speaking to audiences in order to be able to teach. Little by little, I got comfortable with it. And then along comes 9/11, and suddenly the politicians in Wisconsin are witch hunting me, and I'm thrown on Fox News, and I have no choice. So I just got over my phobia, or to the extent you'd call it a phobia, just by doing it. And likewise, you can do any kind of political action that's going to make you feel a little uncomfortable. Just start it. Try a little bit of it. And then maybe you'll get comfortable with that. Try a little more. Find your comfort level. And anybody can do this. Do it gradually. And I think you'll be surprised at how good you'll feel if you're actually getting active and trying to make the world a better place.
Thank you. Media, in your experience of being engaged in politics, right, just want to get your final comment on this. How effective do you think are emails? Because a lot of times we see that emails, you know, a lot of people, you know, want to push forward emails, you know, having a mass email sent to authorities, this and that, you know. I mean, I know the easiest thing to do is delete an email, right, you know. So how effective is that in your experience?
Well, it's among the least effective, but it's better than doing nothing.
Okay.
So, and it's also what you do with those emails, because petitions often are signed and then left in cyberspace. We at Code Pink take those petitions and do something with them. We always deliver them, and we always hand deliver them, except when they're to President Obama, and then we get as close as we can to him. So I think it's important to do the follow-up to those emails. But I do think that we've become way too comfortable thinking about clicktivism, that if you just press something, that you've done your activism. And that has really stopped people from doing the real work of the community getting together, the visits to your congressperson's office, the reaching out to the other. And as Kevin just said, getting out of your comfort zone, I must admit that I was a little uncomfortable about coming here. And I did have to think about it because I am not a religious person. I'm Jewish by ethnicity, but not practicing. And so for me, it was getting out of my comfort zone to come to this place. And I must say, in the short time I've spent with you since last night, I've had such wonderful interactions. I've learned so much. And I have moved beyond the idea of tolerance to one of enjoying and reveling in the diversity among us, and really having a tremendous respect for the people that I've met and for the openness I've felt. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to come here and be part of this.
So I'll give it to Maulana Ilya, if you can give a final comment, you know, on this issue, and you know, see how we can encourage and inspire our people, you know, to be involved.
Our Holy Quran says, "La tazlimuna wa la tazlamun." If you want to define the Islamic activism in a nutshell, this verse is sufficient. When Imam Ali alayhi salam, our first Imam after the Prophet, was asked, he said, give justice to the oppressed. That means when we find somebody is oppressed, we move forward to provide justice and fairness that he deserves. If we move forward to provide justice to those who are oppressed around us, Allah, our Lord, will provide justice to us in our affairs. We do not believe in oppressing any human being, regardless of his faith. And we do not allow anybody to oppress us, because we will stand up for our rights, because rights are never handed over to you in a tray. You have to always battle and fight to get your rights. So my religion teaches that man kana yu'minu billahi wal yawmil akhir falyukrim jarahu. Isn't that right? Our beloved Prophet says, whoever believes in God and the final day must respect his neighbor. And I recall when Imam Khomeini was in Paris in exile, he used to send gifts to his Christian neighbors on the Christmas occasion. So how many of us, my question to you, respectable audience, how many of you and how many of us reach out to our Jewish neighbors and our Christian neighbors and make sure that they feel comfortable with us, and they learn the fact that we as Muslims respect them, and we as Muslims are ready to live with them in a peaceful and a loving way and respectful way, based on mutual respect. When we reach out to them, and we, Imam al-Rahil used to say, "Nahnu we hamiye mustazafane jahani." We are the supporters of all the weakened masses in the world, regardless of their faith. So even if a Jew is oppressed somewhere, if a Christian, a Hindu, anybody is oppressed, we proudly, based on our Islamic moral value system, are obliged to stand in support of every oppressed human being. And when we believe in that and we practice this belief, you know, in our neighborhoods, in our communities, you know, inshallah, God willing, you'll find nice things and good results coming even in the lifetime. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, it's been a short but a fruitful discussion that we had here. I want to thank the panelists who are here, Brother Dawood from CARE, Media Benjamin from Code Pink, Dr. Kevin Barrett, you know, and also Marana Ilya. Thank you very much for being here, enlightening us. And we also really are enlightened and appreciate your presence in our conference. Thank you very much. Thank you, audience. Yeah. If anyone wants to meet the authors, you know, Media Benjamin or Dr. Barrett, they have their books here also. They will be outside. So, inshallah, you know, if you want, you can go there and visit them, see their books. If you want to buy their books, please go ahead, and they'll be there for you to meet them. Thank you very much.